Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. You're in for a great treat. You're going to hear some really tasteful playing and some great music. And I'm a big fan of R&B and funk. And you're going to hear some of that, and you're going to hear a lot of different things. There's some really surprises here. My guest is Joey Delgado from the Delgado Brothers, and they grew up in East LA, and I want to talk a little bit about that area because, we always hear about the LA sound. We always hear about, especially in the 70s and 80s, there was the West Coast sound, the East Coast sound. But there was a lot more than when you think of the LA sound, you think of like Larry Carlton, the Rhythm Sections, the Wrecking Crew. That was like what everybody thought that was the LA sound. But there was a lot more happening musically. And especially in the East LA area, just in terms of luthiers, two big major influences on music here, Candelas Guitars and also Bernardo Rico. And another person, a lot of people didn't know that well, but the inside musicians knew very well, like Eric Clapton and stuff, was Arturo Valdez, who worked on my Les Paul years ago. And these guys were amazing. That's just the luthiers, but there was a lot of music. Probably the most famous from East LA was Los Lobos, but there was El Chicano, Tierra, and the Delgado Brothers. Now, the interesting thing was they took their Latin American influences and integrated it into some of it hard rock. There was two scenes. There was the LA scene, and there was a San Francisco scene, which we all know was made famous by Santana. But what I thought was really interesting, especially with the Delgado Brothers, is they really got into the R&B thing, and they really did a lot of really cool things that was happening that you just didn't expect from that area, but it was part of the influence of what they were hearing. And it was interesting. I was talking to Joey before the show. I had on a few months ago June Millington from Fanny, and I read her book, her biography, and that was one of the big influences, was that R&B sound. That's what they loved, and that was a big influence in their whole, even though their band was a rock band, and she played rock and blues. But I'm going to play a clip to kind of give you a kind of a feel of what the Delgado Brothers are about. But these two albums that I was looking at to, set up for the show, Learn to Fly and A Brother's Dreams, there's so much diversity on the album, and it's more than even just R&B. It's more than Latin rock, if you want to say that. And in fact, I found so many other things in there. It's obvious that Joey's influence are far beyond what people would suspect. I mean, and we're going to talk a little bit about his influences, and I'm going to show you some playing. It just will blow you away. And it's not just electric, but acoustic. I mean, he's a great blues player. Tone is amazing, as you'll hear in this cut. But the thing is that he does a lot of different things. His folk picking, finger picking style. You can tell he's got a great ear, and he's doing a lot of different things. And very, I think one of the things that impressed me the most about the Delgado brothers is how versatile they are. They're playing a lot of different styles. So I want to welcome Joey to the show, and I want to play this clip. It's from the Learn to Fly album, and it's called I Want to Know. And I edited two parts of it. There's a lot of vocals. I mean, they sing, but I cut in, like, I went to one of the leads. I went to the intro and went to the lead. So you can take a listen to this. This is very good. So this is I Want to Know. Welcome to the show, Joey. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Jeff. You make me feel great. Thank you so much. This is awesome.
No, I mean, the sound you're getting out of your guitar, I mean, it's just a great tone.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Now, was that the 335?
Yeah, the 335.
That you have here.
Right.
And then what amps do you use?
At the time, I think I had my Bassman amp. No, I might have had the Super Reverb. I'm not really sure because there's a story about my Super Reverb. I have a 1966 Blackface Super that I bought when I was a kid, about 16 or 17 years old, and I think I paid like $200 for it or something.
And, you still have it?
Well, I had it and I sold it because I'd go see Larry Carlton. I was telling you that story about seeing Larry Carlton, and so I sold my beautiful Super Reverb that had the most amazing tone. And just because I had to get a Boogie, because Larry had one.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately after I got the Boogie, I hated it and tried to sell it and get my Super back, but it was already gone. This mariachi band had bought it from Cronin's Music Store in Montebello. And then
let that be a lesson. Do not sell people out there. My friends know me. A friend of mine, we were talking about him, Henry Sendejas, that's another guitar friend from Whittier.
Right.
And he still has his, and it still has that sound.
Yeah.
Because around that time, they were using Alnico. The 10s had Alnicos, unless you had the JBLs, which were Alnicos too. But his tone, I've never heard any amp like, I mean, just Sounds yeah, it, great.
So the short story or short version of my story is, Big Manny from the Blazers bought the amp from the mariachi, the accordion player, because his son had taken the speakers out and used it in his Chevy van. So the amp was sitting there without speakers, and he proceeded to use that amp for like 35 years, and then he sold it to the Goss family, you know, a few years ago, and I just happened to find out Bruce Goss and his son. And I just happened to run into him at a dinner dance, and Bruce mm-hmm. was playing the gig, and I started talking to him about my amp, the one that got away, you know. And he listens to me, and he puts his head back, and he goes, "Joe, I have your amp." And I just about passed out. Anyway, so the following Monday, his son was going to put it on eBay, and it was that close, you know. So he didn't put it on eBay. I bought it, you know, I paid $900 to get it back. And proceeded to spend like $3,000 to get it restored because it was trashed. Mm. But I had to have it. You know, I just had to have it.
That's a classic amp. And it's interesting because a lot of the people I know that played with brass bands at the time, later in the 70s, there were a lot of groups that were doing the Chicago thing and the Blood, Sweat, and right. Tears thing. They used the Super. The Tens cut.
Yeah.
With a Strat and that.
If I run it past 3.5, I'm going to hurt somebody. You know, it's just dynamic and it has a great sound. It's different than what it was. I know it doesn't sound, it's kind of like your mom's cooking. You think you remember what your mom's cooking is like, and then, you know, you have it and you go, oh, that's not quite what I remember.
Well, also, too, it depends on what speakers. If you had the original speakers.
I had the two original speakers. I carried them around for like, I don't know, 40 years, whatever it was. And I just happened to have them stored in my box of junk upstairs, and I had them reconed and put them back in. So I have the two original speakers, and then I had to replace two. So I did have the original foot pedal, mm-hmm. and it's great. I mean, I don't regret it, you know, but it's not the same amp, you know.
Yeah.
And I come to find out that sometimes these repair guys, they know what the capacitors are, whatever the, you know, diodes or what's inside the amp, and they replace them with a cheaper Chinese version of that, you know, transistor. You know, that's urban legend, maybe. I don't know. But
I know that I had all my old Fenders recapped about 3 or 4 years ago. I have like a 63 Bandmaster and some other ones that are like later 60s. And they last about 40 years, and then the caps right. go. And these guys, actually, the guy that restored it for me, he looked to try to find as close as he could, but there's no way you can get exactly. They're just, they vary too much. The capacitors are very, so it will change it. But I noticed that, like, I have a Bassman too,
yeah.
that I use a lot for guitar, and when we put the caps in, it got louder and cleaner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really like sounded twice as loud as it used to, and it was still a 45 watt Bassman.
Yeah, my amp is loud, and I, you know, I'm looking to get it maybe tweaked one more time, you know, but it's right now it's good. I'm happy with
it. So you use that amp for gigging?
Yep. That's the thing about now that we're touring a lot more, it's a little difficult utilizing a backline and trying to make those sing like your home amps. And it's a challenge, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Well, when you recorded this song, I want to know, what was the amp that you used there?
Well, I believe it was a Super Reverb. I can't remember.
That killer sound.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to play another clip. I'm going to play this, and this is totally different. This is much more harder edged. And this is from the Brothers Dream, and we'll talk about it, because I want to kind of show the diversity that I'm hearing on the two albums. And this is called Mama's Crying. Check this out, because you're really just kind of just screaming in here. It's really good. Here's Mama's Crying. We'll be right back. Now, except for the vocals, I would have never thought that's the same band. I mean, that is just a cool rocker, and you're doing that great little riff that.
Well, so this, you know, obviously it's influenced by a Hendrix, you know, kind of groove. Mm-hmm. But what happened? This song took on about we have our own studio, which is a good and a bad thing. This song took about three or four times. We recorded it three mm-hmm. or four times. But what brought it together? I went to the NAMM show one year, and Buzzy Featon was sitting there doing a demo on a loop pedal. Mm-hmm. And he did that, and I'll play it for you a little bit. So he was doing this. And then he created a loop, and then he proceeded to rip, you know, right through the song. Just, mm-hmm. you know. But so I took that. I stole that from Buzzy. And then,
I love that riff. That's a great riff.
And if you notice, it's kind of like I use my finger as a pull off. It's like. So that's how I do that one.
That's a great no. What were you using there? Was that the super?
No, this was recorded at the believe it or not, the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove.
Oh wow.
Well, no. The track was, but the guitar overdub was done at John. You know John Avila from the Oingo Boingo Band.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he makes the last two albums for us, and Ray Moore is our audio engineer. But so John, I had to overdub the guitar parts, and we went to a studio in Temple City. And I set up my guitar, and I knew this was going to be a rocker, so I turned it all the way up to, you know, as long as I can get it. So halfway into the session, his wife comes on and says, you're going to need to turn that down. And I was like, ooh! I was like, you know, what do I do now? So we proceeded to cover it with blankets, and I turned the amp down to, like, I don't know, next to nothing, like one or two. And at the time, I was using a blues driver, the Boss blues driver. Mm-hmm. And so I was so lucky to get that killer tone. You know, just at a very low volume. That's not where.
Well, those supers were known to be really, really clean, and you could, you know, like the Birds used them with their Rickenbackers. And
no, that one was the Bassman. That was a Bassman.
Yeah, oh,
that's,
okay.
One of the early reissues. I got that from Jeff Craig.
That's a great. Yeah. That's just a rude.
Yeah.
Just a rude sound. As they call it is. It's just great.
Yeah.
But the. Well, let's talk a little bit about your influences, because it's got to be very. And I just want to mention one thing about that clip. Listen, I mean, for a heavy rocker, it's kind of cool having the timbale thing going on in there. It's an interesting blend of that, but it still has it keeps that character of just a solid stomper, you know?
Yeah, if you've seen a Delgado Brothers show, that's really indicative of the way we approach our music. It's like, you know, go for the juggler. But then, you know, the other thing about that song that has to happen when we record or write something, it's got to find a groove, it's got to find a pocket. Mm-hmm. It's not blatant, you know, rock. It's just mm-hmm. so if you know, like you notice the way I did the riff, I think it's a beautiful riff. It's like it has a little bit of like a picking technique.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you know, when you turn the overdrive up to 10, it's got a little more guts to it, you know.
Well, I love that riff. Yeah. That's still killer. So, but let's go into your real quick your influences.
Okay.
Because you've listened, it's obvious you listened to a lot of different things.
Well, so I was so lucky to grow up in my family. My parents didn't play music themselves. My father loved music, but he was not for us playing music. You know, he grew up in the era when, you know, Gene Krupa from Benny Goodman Band was a heroin addict. So he thought any musician that, you know, was going to do that was going to be a heroin addict. So. Mm. So my brother Eddie, the oldest one in our family, he started playing music with his friends from high school, and he used to have to sneak out. So he told Dad that he was selling newspapers, and he, you know, stick his suit and tie in a lunch bag and go to his gig. And then one day, you know, he caught Eddie in the corner, you know, with his friends, and he goes, "So how was work tonight?" And he goes, "Oh, it was great, Dad." He goes, "You're lying to me, you know." I saw you hanging out with your friends. So anyway, Eddie took the grunt of it, but he went on to have his bands, the Amertones, which became very popular in the East LA scene, playing with the Midnighters. And
did your dad get to see them
play? Oh yeah.
Then he was.
Okay, he was fine with it after, but it was like at first, you know, he didn't want anything to do with it. And then my brother Bob, my older brother Bob. So there's six Delgado brothers in the family and five sisters. And so all the brothers played music, and the sisters didn't for some reason. I don't know what happened. You know, they.
But you had a vocal section there.
Yeah,
at
no,
least.
They. You know, there a couple of them tried, but they. You know,
if they only learned violins. You'd have a string section.
Well, we always say my mom was three shy of a horn section with the brothers. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, so so back going back to the influences. So a lot of those early influences were for the guys at my brother's band, Henry Hernandez and Felix. I forget his last name, but he was in the Exotics. My brother Danny was a great guitar player, in, you know, back in the early '60s. And so what happened is a lot of these bands were very, you know, they would like go to three or four dances a night and be very exciting. And when they would practice at our house, all these pretty girls would come over and hang out. And you know, so I, man, this is what I want to do. And then also the Beatles were, you know, coming around. And so a lot of the playing that I first learned was because of these guys coming into the house. Mm-hmm. And I would bug them, and they would show me stuff. And my other brother, Jimmy, was another amazing guitarist, but he also was coming up with me at the same time. He was older, so he was able to hang out with the older guys more than I was. Mm-hmm. But I was still, you know, I was still there at the jam sessions. You know, we can teach me something. And there was a couple of guys, Danny Diaz, who's a local legend in the San Gabriel Valley, East L.A. area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He really took the time to take me aside after the jams, and he would show me scales. He would show me Beatles songs. He would show me all these things, proper fingering, proper picking techniques, you know. And it was really, to this day, I practice that stuff.
But with all your brothers and sisters, you probably had a lot of different music playing on the radio.
Well, yeah, that was
all the time. So you were, what did you guys listen to?
Well, that was the other thing. So after the, you know, in the late '60s, of course, all the British blues invasion was happening in the '60s. But then my brother Bob, after that started happening, he realized, you know, thanks to Eric Clapton and everybody else, You guys got Albert King and B.B. King over here. You guys, you know, pay attention, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So Bob took into that right away. You know, he got into, like, all these bands that were, like, the real deal. So I'm 9-10 years old listening to Albert King, you know, Crosscut Saw and all this stuff. And I got it. You know, I was like, I could hear that. The way the guitars were, the space and the rhythm section, the, you know, all these things, the way the drums was very sparsely placed. And I just loved it. You know, and the horns were, like, off to the left side on their own and whatever. And just all these things, I really paid attention to it, you know. And I, to this day, I mean, that's really my true love, is to produce records and arrange and write.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting in the songs, too. Now, the main band is now a five-piece, right? You're on guitar. Bob, your brother's on bass. Steve's
right.
on drums. David Kelly's on keys.
Right.
And then Ish Panera?
Pineda.
Pineda.
Panera's the braid.
Pineda.
No, but Ish has he joined the group maybe about just over a year ago, and he's been playing off and on with us, you know, and he's amazing. He sets the groove and he gets it. You know, that's the other thing about percussion, is it's a fine art to play blues and rock.
Well, the thing that's really cool, and we're going to show that in some of the clips, is where you guys find space for each other.
Right.
And we were talking, you know, when we talked earlier in the week, you were mentioning about the importance of a rhythm player.
Right.
And playing rhythm. But I noticed even with the fills that you do, and you give space and you fill in the spaces when you need to. You're not like going against each other.
Right.
And I think, which is interesting, and what I wanted to ask you too is, okay, you're playing most of the time as a five piece, but on your records with the brass,
right,
you have a lot more stuff. How do you approach your guitar playing with a big section, like with a brass section, as opposed to just the smaller combo?
Well, I mean, going back to like listening to Albert King, for instance, you know, I used to love the way that like he would do. There'd be a horn line, and then all he would do is that one note, bing, you know, just sting it like, you know, there'd be like a. Let me play a little bit. And then he would just go, and then the horn section would go. You know what I mean? And so something like that. So anyway, I always wanted to have that idea on the recording. And so what happened on that album, it was also a tribute to, I felt, our roots in East L.A. We wanted to have songs that reflected what we were listening to, but not necessarily cover songs. You know, that was I think, a part of the problem with the East L.A. rock and roll scene. The reason it wasn't bigger than it was and more national is because they weren't writing music. They were interpreting music from Philadelphia and from Detroit,
right,
and from San Francisco and everywhere else, but they weren't writing music, you know, most of them. You know, some of them were, but a lot of them weren't. So what you had was a lot of bands doing cover songs. My brother Bob tells me the story that, you know, like if you did a Rolling Stone song like Gloria, the other band knows that you guys did Gloria, so they won't do Gloria. You know, that kind of thing. So,
and you have to understand back in the, especially in the 60s, a lot of the gigs, you know, there were clubs, but a lot of the gigs, especially the rock bands, were playing high schools and,
right,
and maybe colleges and dances, and they wanted to hear the hits. So
right,
it was almost like top 40 later in the 70s, but you had to kind of played what they wanted, right, you know. So you
and
were
then,
doing
you
covers.
Know, now that I think about it, too, the other thing was you could never have a sound system sound as good as a live band back then. You know, so prior to disco, when you know, there's a story about what I love disco, why I love disco so much is because I got out of that music genre. I you know, Delgado Brothers, the original Delgado Brothers band, was playing five nights a week, five sets a night, brutal.
Yeah,
and we were doing, you know, all the hits. Donna Summer, Stevie hadn't, you know, reached puberty yet, so he was singing the high parts. And but anyway, that's, you know, like, and I was telling you about rhythm, you know, rhythm playing. So, you know, in hindsight, I really appreciate that was my 10,000 hours of learning how to play rhythm. And then, you know, because of disco back then, you know, we could play a Donna Summer song and jam in the middle of like an Allman Brothers song, but nobody, as long as we had the groove going, you know, and they were dancing, they didn't care what we did. So that's where we developed a lot of our playing, you know, improvisation during that part.
Well, I'm going to play a clip real quick. This one is shows that R&B rhythm, and there's some your classic fills. You put your fills in there. This is, again, from Learn to Fly. And this is called this clip is called All I Have. And this kind of demonstrates what you're talking about.
That's exactly what the Ambertones. This is kind of a tribute to the Ambertones. Like, had they written a song? My brother did write a couple for Ambertones, but this is one that we just kind of like, we just took everything that we could dream of and put it into this song.
Okay, let's take a listen. So you can hear there, he's got two guitars. There's one that's doing the in the back on one side, and then you have another guy just doing some very simple fills, but it's perfect. But there's a lot of stuff going on that song.
Yeah.
You got the brass doing syncopated things, and then the organ's kind of doing little fills too.
Yeah, so the horn arrangements were done by Lee Thornburg and Pauly Serra, who now play with Joe Bonamassa. And there's a funny story. When that album came out, I called Lee. I said, Lee, we have the album coming out, and you know, we'd love for you to be at the CD release party. He goes, I'd love to, but I'm going to be with Joe Bonamassa at the Royal Albert Hall with Eric Clapton. I go, oh.
Okay.
Anyway, so and there's a video. So if you look at that video with Joe Bonamassa and Lee Thornburg, that's the same time we were having our CD release party at the Hyatt in Monrovia.
No, those are classic. Yeah, those horn charts.
He's amazing.
Just killer.
He's
but you get an idea of the interaction of all the of the groups. Now, he did the horn arrangements, but
right.
Now, in your writing process, how much did you dictate? What did you need, or what did, or you just showed him the groove, and then he put what he wanted?
Yeah, he pretty much created the parts. You know, I had an idea. I mean, I told him the my inspiration for the song, and it's just to be straight ahead R&B, you know, funk, and that's what he did. And he's so prolific, I guess, is a good word for him, because, you know, I gave him all 12 songs just because we had the demo done, kind of, sort of. And he wrote song horns for the ballads. I mean, the acoustic song that we did. So it's just like, oh, okay, Lee, it's a little much.
Yeah, but I mean,
he's just great.
But also, too, the songs that I played, the clips that I played, they're totally different in style, but it's the same band. And that's what I wanted to show. Speaking of acoustic, I'm going to play another clip for you. This one's, again, from the it's an interesting interplay between the acoustic guitar and the Wurlitzer electric piano. It's called In Time. But, again, totally different style and some killer playing on the acoustic guitar. Some great riffs in it. And this is, well, let's play it, and you'll see what I'm talking about. This is called In Time.
That's the Gibson.
I'm walking so slowly down the streets of yesterday. Thought I saw you there, must have been a dream. So much gets lost in the shadows of the tree. It's a thin line between shade and gray. In time, we'll know no boundaries. In time, the truth will be revealed. In time, love will rule the world. In time, a love so strong, so real. If you want to know a secret, I'll tell you.
It's interesting. You were using the Gibson there. A few weeks ago, I had Snuffy Walden on, and I had him on earlier on the Flow Guitar Show, and he gets this great growl out of his. Mm. He has a really old pre-war Martin, and it's just like that sound. We're both fans of Stephen Stills, and you know, on his solo album, he did Black Queen on acoustic, and it gets that growl.
Right,
yeah. And you're getting that growl. Yeah. I'm like, wow, that's just like... But again, I mean, I would have never thought that was a Delgado Brothers song, but except for the voice. But wow. I mean, yeah. What were your acoustic influences?
Let me think about it. Well, I love James Taylor. I think his playing's way underrated as an acoustic player. And he's always been a big hero of mine. And then the early Beatles, during the White Album, a lot of that stuff, like Julia and Blackbird, of course. And, so I learned Blackbird a long time ago. You know, I love acoustic finger picking.
But I mean, those riffs and stuff, those are not Blackbird and...
Well, yeah, so I was telling you, I wanted to play... So this, like on In Time...
That's right, tune up while I'm taking a picture.
Yeah. Just stuff like that. I mean, I try to utilize the open strings to give it a big sound.
And, yeah, we were talking earlier before the show that a lot of people ask you what tuning you're using, and you're actually regular standard.
Yeah, just regular tuning. Yeah.
Let me show. This will actually give you a good idea of that. Again, one of the things I wanted to mention about In Time is the work on David Kelly did. The way he counterpoints what you're playing guitar-wise.
Well, that's Dave Kelly.
He's amazing.
Yeah, we get along really well.
Here's another cut of the. This is from the other album, The Brother's Dream. This is called Picture of You. But take a listen again. If I'm correct, there's another counter. He's using acoustic piano on this one, but I think that. The counterpoint and the type of finger picking style, it kind of shows what we're talking about here. Take a listen.
Saw a picture of you today. I saw it in your eyes. all the words that you didn't say. I saw it in your eyes. The love of family was so strong, I know. Deep in her strength, I saw it in your eyes. The joy of simple things, all the smile you bring. A higher love to teach, I saw it in your eyes. I saw a picture of you today. I saw it in your
It makes you appreciate how versatile the Hammond organ was. I mean, what he's doing on the piano against the guitar, the counterpoint is great, but then that organ just comes in. It's just a little fill in the background, but it's just so beautiful. And that Hammond, just that sound is to die for.
Yeah, but we recorded this album at my friend's house, Lisa Reynoso, and she had a little grandma house in the back, and she was using it as storage. And at the time, I didn't have a studio. And so I asked her, I go, you know, what about if we, clean out your storage and, make it into a studio? And she was cool with that. So
it sounded great. Yeah. I mean, it really, and was that the Gibson too?
Yeah, that's also, no. Actually, that's like a 1928 Dobro that I borrowed from a friend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the reason I did that, I wrote that, the music for it. And we were on a trip to Hawaii many, many years ago. And somebody had a Dobro, and I was playing it on this, overlooking the beautiful ocean and the sun setting, and I just kind of came up.
And you can hear that drone string that he's doing. That's standard tuning, but it sounds like a...
Something like that,
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I did that one.
God, that doesn't... I mean, I could have sworn... It's an interesting sound you got out of the Dobro. It sounds very acoustic, more than... usually the Dobro has a little,
metallic,
metallic sound.
Yeah, this was an older Dobro, and it was real mellow, and it was hard to keep it in tune, and, but it worked.
But it's those funky...
And then my brother Bob plays a upright bass on that, and he uses the bow on the E string as a drone.
Oh, so that's what that low-end drone is.
Just hear this, groan on the in the back. It's just... It was fun making that song. It was very creative.
Both of the albums, there's a lot of different things going on in there. And I think that you guys, as far as your R&B stuff, is to die for too. But, that acoustic, that In Time is a great, it's a great song. Yeah. It fits well. You sure you only just listen to James Taylor? I'm hearing like all sorts of stuff in there. It's amazing.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, you're right about Stephen Stills. There was a lot of that stuff that I listened to, like the Crosby, Stills, and Nash early albums, and the way they picked it, and they were very percussive and driving, and Neil Young, was another guy. But, I don't think they had the finesse that I was looking for. And, there were a lot of those guys were like, they were hitting those acoustics hard.
Yeah,
but James Taylor to me had the finesse. He would his finger picking was very, very precise.
Yeah,
and he always had great tone. I listened to the early albums, and the production value on those early albums were amazing.
Yeah, well, if you see the videos of him like at the Beacon Hall and stuff, his playing is just impeccable. But he always was really he was a really cool player. It's amazing though. Now you use all your fingers, right?
I have three.
You use three, so you do the same thing James Taylor. Because I mean, from learning classical, I use the three fingers and the thumb. Nah. So it's interesting because you guys. With the two and the two fingers and the thumb, you get some pretty complex rhythm things going on.
And I use that all the time. Like even when I'm playing electric, I like to I'll put my pick in my mouth and I'll do like stuff because you get mm-hmm. You get like a whole different vibe. Like
it's So you mix it up. You do it. So it just gives you another whole dimension.
Yeah.
And especially with that guitar and your Les Paul, those two guitars sound great. I mean, electrically, but then acoustically.
Yeah, this I think this guitar has a better, this is the 335, and it has more of a percussive acoustic sound. You know, when you get it right, like what I like to do too is put it in the middle position and roll off the rhythm pickup a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, put the treble pickup full bright, and you get a nice. It's just right in the middle. It's perfect.
Well, you get an especially when you do the in the R&B stuff in your rhythm playing, using that guitar. I think it's with the two pickups. You get a really nice sound that's similar to like a you would normally hear off a Tele or a Strat. Like sounds single coil, but it isn't.
Well, I do have. I was endorsed by G&L in the early '90s, and they gave me an Asat and a Legacy.
Oh,
and they're both
nice.
They're both great guitars, and so like going back to that song In Time, I use there's a little electric parts in there, and that's the Tally going through, I think the Super with a vibro, and you know it's just all mixed up, but it has a great crunchy.
Do you use the G&Ls live?
Oh yeah,
when
I'm playing locally, I'll take like three or four guitars. You know, and it depends on an event. We talked about a Barney Kessel, and I have a '67 Barney Kessel that I bought from Bob Robas. Who's another one of my great teachers. And anyway, so that guitar, it has it's a challenge. You know, sometimes you got to get used to these instruments, like, because if you take them out and you try to play them, it's like, you know, it takes a while to get that vibe, you know, find the right balance of the volume and not too much overdrive, or don't use overdrive at all, and play it clean. And then you got to, you know, change your approach to the playing.
Right.
So,
now, when you play live, when you do like something like In Time, do you still use the Gibson, or do you have another guitar that's electric acoustic?
Well, primarily what we'll do is like I've adapted the guitar, the electrics to, you know, just play the parts electric. You know, they'll be clean, or I'll put a subtle vibrato effect or a chorus. But, you know, we have a version of the Brothers that's an acoustic trio, and we just played last Monday in Oregon at a little club called the Burke, and we did an acoustic trio up there, and it was so much fun. You know, we were able to do all these songs like In Time and songs that we wouldn't normally do at a festival setting. So that was a lot of fun, and we do that. We used to do it quite a bit in town, but we haven't done it lately. So it was good to bring out the old songs.
No, I know it's a hassle to bring a lot of guitars when you're touring and stuff, but God, electric acoustic, you get your stuff like In Time, that kind of stuff, that type of playing. It's just killer. It's great stuff.
Thank you.
And let's real quick. We're almost out of time, and I want to.
You told me that was going to happen.
I knew, but go really quick. Take us through your pedal board. I'm sure people are going to want to know about that.
Well, right now I have the pedal board that I'm using, and I guess you're going to show photos of it.
Yeah, I'll post it up on Facebook.
This is the travel version of my normal pedal board, and I have a Wazoo wah pedal. And the reason I use that was because it has an auto wah function that, like on that song, I want to know when I hit that part, you know, wow, wow, wow. The auto wah, I use that.
Were you using that pedal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then the polytune, I think that's an issue to everybody that's over 55 years old, because you can see it from a mile away.
Yes.
And it's great. You could hit the, you know, open strings and it's unbelievable how that works. And then I have the Caveman Overdrive. It's made by Oddfellows, and my buddy John, who's actually builds those. And so, and that's so cool, because I could talk to him and he'll tell me, you know, well, set it up like this, try this, because it has a pre-post function on the overdrive. And so I use it on the pre-mode anyway, and it gives me a lot more of a direct
just punch
presence,
though.
Yeah.
Because you crank up the amp live, right? You run the...
Well, no, I mean, I tried, you know, like the other thing I'm doing live now is playing at a lower volume, and I use one of the sound shields, and I'm trying to get, you know, more gain into the pedal going into the amp instead of trying to drive the amp and driving everybody crazy with the volume.
But it gets you the sound that you want.
Well, it's a fine line. Sometimes I'll get it and it sounds like too much pedal, and I'm like, ugh.
Because there's especially your basement. When you crank that basement up, it's a different world.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other pedal I have is an old analog delay, Boss delay, and then I got this recently, the TC Electronics chorus. The reason I bought that was for two reasons. I wanted a subtle chorus effect, or actually a univibe effect, But I got this one because it has dual outputs. So now when I'm playing locally, I'll use two amps. I have my Super Reverb, and then part of my prize package for the Memphis win was I got a Category 5 amp, which is an amazing amp. Mm-hmm. And so I'm using both of those in tandem. And in the chorus, when I kick in the chorus, it gives me a nice little swirl effect. You know, but I rarely use it. I primarily use it just to split the signal.
Yeah.
So, and then just the DC power.
It's pretty simple and to the point.
I mean, really, I don't think there's a lot of stuff to it. I try to keep it simple and straight ahead. And
what's the difference on your bigger pedal board? Is there just...
I'm trying to think if there's
something. More things to have presets, or is it...
No, I think the only difference would be I had an A-B switch on there that I probably won't use anymore because I have the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
But the A-B switch, what I tried to do with that was like bypass going through the tuner. I try to eliminate a couple of effects, you know, so when I kick in the tuner, it goes directly to the tuner, and then I bypass like two pedals when I'm not in it. So, I don't know, it's just, you know, because the signal path is very, very... very fickle.
Okay, there's two things I want to mention before, or talk about really quick, because we're almost out of time. A, I want to talk about the fact that John Mayall covered two of your songs.
Well, that's another show.
But you played on his album.
Well, yes, I did. And so, real quickly, our producer, John Juke Logan, who did our album, Let's Get Back, he was friends with Joe Ueli, the drummer from John Mayall's band at the time. And so he was able to get him an album or CD to Joe Ueli and told him, hey, you know, finder's fee, if you hook it up with John. And so he was able to get the album to John, and John fell in love with If I Don't Get Home and Something About My Baby. But so during the recording process, we get a call because for some reason they weren't copping the groove on the tracks. They felt like it wasn't happening. So he called us up, and, you know, all three of us, me, Bob, and Steve, but Steve couldn't get out of work at the time to do it. So me and Bob went down there, and we knock on the door, and the first thing he does is apologize, because he goes, well, Billy Gibbons is on his way down and he's got to do his part in Split. So I said, gee, bummer, you know, I got to watch Billy Gibbons record. So we proceeded to watch him play, and we had a wonderful time, and he happened to know who we were, you know, from Juke Logan and everybody else. So that was kind of fun. And so after he did the parts, you know, it was our turn to go sit down and play. And so I did exactly what I did on the original recording. I played the rhythm part, and then Gary Moore, he does the rest of the solos on the album. And then he passed away like 3 or 4 months after the album was done. And so that's, you know, it's really, really, and it's some incredible playing what he does in there. Just crazy. And after I heard Gary Moore play what he did, I was like, I want to go back and re-record my track, you know. But anyway, so that album that it came out was John Mayall's Along for the Ride.
Along for the Ride.
Yeah, and it was kind of a tribute album to himself. He had Billy Preston on there, Steve Miller, Otis Rush. He had Billy Gibbons. He had, I mean, everybody.
Well, it's interesting that he brought you in to get the groove right, because you guys wrote the song, and he liked your original groove. To me, that means a lot.
And then after we recorded it, Bob laid down the bass pattern, and I did my guitar rhythm, and then the engineer, David Z, he called John in to listen to it. And John's, my favorite compliment was, feels like a warm bath. You know, I said, oh, I love it. You know, I thought that was great.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I want to mention is I want you to talk a little bit about this documentary film that's being made.
Yeah, we've been working on this film. It's entitled In Time After the Song. Mm-hmm. And we started working on it about 3 years ago. And how that came to be was I was working on a friend's house doing some handyman work, because that's kind of what I do aside from my audiovisual work. And halfway through the project, I was converting his... you know, a little back house that he had. He ran out of money. And so I knew he was a filmmaker. And I said, you know what? I have all these amazing stories about my brothers when we were growing up in the East LA rock and roll scene. And then, you know, plus the story of us, you know, we've been playing for 45 years together.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we'd go on the road, you know, to go to a show, part of the process was to get back to the room and have a few beers. And my brother Bob or Eddie would tell these amazing stories about how it was back in the day. And I'm thinking in my mind, how do I document this? You know, because it's just incredible. It was so much fun, and the history was, you know, so well, important.
It's part of it's part of the whole scene. It's,
and that's how we grew up. I mean, we would talk about the different players that would come to the jam sessions. And there's one story real quick was like, just for example, was like my brother Bob would host a jam on Sunday afternoons. My dad would let him, you know, okay, you could do this, but 10 o'clock, you're done. You know, that's kind of thing. So there would literally be a line of guitar players out the door, you know, trying to jam with my Danny Diaz, who was like the kingpin at the time, and or Bob Robles and all these guys that were just incredible. So you'd have all these young, you know, gunslingers come out, and it was like the original jam sessions. So that's how that came to be. So the movie is it goes back and it tells a story about how the music from the Delgado family point of view came to be, and we, you know, the East LA rock and roll scene, and you know all the things that we had gone through as artists, you know, starting with our High Tone record and the disappointment. But then in hindsight, you know, the Dark Angel that we experienced with that label.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it taught us a lot of things about the music industry.
Right.
That we probably never would have learned.
And then now it's almost done, so it's going to be coming out soon.
Yeah, so the cool thing about it, you know, the director of the film was trying to come up with a overarching theme of the film, like so something, you know, we'd have a beginning and an ending, and some of the ideas that he had weren't, you know, they weren't like moving us. We were like, I don't know, this feels pretentious, it didn't feel right or whatever. So then comes along the Memphis International Blues Challenge, and so they offered to go along with us, and let's you know, win or lose, let's go, you know. So we just happened to win first place, and I happened to win the international, you know.
That's great.
It's just, it's like a Disney ending. And so so now we have the ending to our film, so now we're looking for funding and everything else to try to get it completed, and we're hoping like either late this year or early spring next year.
Okay. No, that's great. Check out www.delgadobrothers.com, and you know, there's more information on the film and all their music. Also, too, I pulled clips from Learn to Fly and A Brother's Dreams, but they also have another one, Let's Get Back. All these albums. I mean, there's so much. I only just gave you a snippet of all the different things that are happening. It's great music. Great music to listen in the car, great music to dance to, whatever. And it's so diverse. I think you heard a little bit of the different things and the variety that the Delgado brothers are doing in their music. So I want to thank you. Real quick, any place you're playing and what's coming up?
Well, you could check out our website. Like you said, there's a schedule on there. We're coming to we're so blessed with all these different festivals that we're doing. But, you know, the big news is we go to Brussels next Saturday for a one-hour show. And we can't wait to get there. It'll be the first time the brothers ever been to Europe. So we're real excited about
very
that.
Very cool. Yeah. Very, very cool.
And then also, you could like us on Facebook. You could follow our adventures on there.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a bunch of festivals, and we're really looking forward to playing all over the country.
Well, so. We're out of time, but darn, we got to have you come back. I mean, that's all it means is... It's a real pleasure. I mean, you're an amazing player, and your tone, man, to die for.
Thank
it's
you
just
so
great.
Much.
I'm going to leave us. I'm going to play a little bit more lengthier clip for the end, but it's well worth it. And it kind of sums up what we were talking about. And this is called Be the One. It's from Learn to Fly. And I think you'll like it. I cut two pieces together so you get the – but he does a whole little lead thing at the end of it. So we'll leave you with that. Everybody have a great week, and we will see you next week. But thank you so much.
That's also Dave. It's me and Dave Melton playing.
Right, he's doing the slide guitar. There's a slide guitar in there, but there's some great interplay between the two, and there's some really interesting things that he's doing in there. And then also too, look at how he's the key thing in there is how he's in his little. There's a little pocket that he goes to, and he plays, and it really is critical to hear. I mean, to me, that's what makes it. It's just tasty, and when you need it, it's there when you need it. If it wasn't there, you'd notice it, that kind of thing. So anyway, everybody have a great week. Listen to this clip. It's really beautiful, and we will see you next week. This is Be the One, and this is from the Learn to Fly album.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.